So much has happened since I last saw you. I lost my hammer, like yesterday, so that's still pretty fresh.
And then I went on a journey of self-discovery. Where I met you.
Welcome back to Film Dispenser Prime. I'm one of your hosts, Spencer.
And I'm Scott.
And Scott, I'm throwing myself on my own sword right away. I just did it on my Star Wars podcast, except it was a lightsaber I threw myself on top of. But we are behind schedule, and it is my fault, and I'm giving that to the audience right now. No thoughts negative towards Scott. It is my fault. My life was a little crazy last week, but in between that, we did record an episode, and I have a two-year-old, and my two-year-old loves what he calls booze, which are not boozes, B-O-O-Z-E, but I just realized how it sounds. It's B-O-O-S, but that's buttons to him, and he found my keyboard and started clacking away when I wasn't home and deleted our last podcast, which sounds like my dog ate my homework, but it's a real thing. But fortunately, go ahead.
It just means he heard it and said, oh, God, you can't put this out, and just deleted it.
Quality control for the audience. but I did make a brand new podcast setup. I had much more relaxed on a very comfy couch, and I was very relaxed in my downstairs area, which he now loves. But now I have a desk set up. Everything's nice and neat. He can't reach it for another 3 months till he grows 3 more feet or something. So we're good for a little while longer, and I apologize for our delay, and thank you all listeners and Scott for your patience with me and my crazy life.
Absolutely.
Well, what we do here, besides make apologies at the beginning of podcast, is talk about film and pop culture, sort of our lives and how we're intersecting with those things, what we're watching, sort of stream of consciousness. We don't have a big format, which we sort of like because it lets us cover a lot of subjects. So I usually start us off with something I know we mutually have in common or have mutually seen, but we exchanged some conversations and we got some pictures from one of our fellow Film Dispenser podcasters about the Criterion sale, which is going on now at Barnes & Noble. It sounds like you've hit it up, man. And tell me first, before you jump in, your history with the Criterion sale, because you are my favorite friend with that sale. I just love to hear what you're doing with it every 6 months or so.
Yeah, I the funny thing is when it comes to Criterion, I was really late to the dance. I mean, I was a big film enthusiast years ago, of course, but mostly in a theater. I didn't do as much home video and certainly not movie collecting. And then I got introduced to the Criterion Collection, these definitive editions of these great films with, you know, extras and special features on it that'll just make you drool. And so, but I didn't own any. And so one of the things that I did initially was found people on eBay who, for whatever reason, were needing to sell chunks of their Criterion Collection. And so I snapped up some of them in lots, in auction lots on eBay. And so if you have something that would, you know, normally sticker price in a store for $40 that you could, you know, get during the sale for $20, I may have averaged only paying, say, $5 for it by buying it in a lot. And so that helped me kind of build up a little bit of a catalog of Criterions without just absolutely breaking the bank. And then a couple times a year, Barnes & Noble has this 50% off sale. And so they do it in July. They do it in November. And so I try to be a good boy and not buy any of them in the off months when they would be full price or, you know, 65-75% of full price, and wait for the half price sale, and then have my little 10% off gift card, or I mean not discount card rather, at Barnes & Noble. And to the math challenged out there, that does not mean it's 60% off. My math teacher wife explained the difference to me. But it's 50% off and then 10% off of that price. So you can wind up getting the average $40 Criterion for, I don't know, somewhere around $19, $18.50, something like that. And so, yes, I have a tendency to maybe set a little money aside each month between the sales. And then when the sale hits, you know, I'll go load up on whatever the year's offerings are that I'm really interested in. So it tends to be a pretty substantial buy for me when the sale comes around.
Yeah, my history with the sale is a little bit different. I've been going to it for almost as long as they've been doing it. Usually to pick up one thing for a while. Then I got a real big boy job and I spent way too much money and got in some trouble because I couldn't stop doing it. And my wife is like, "Hey, we just got married and we're sort of building a life. Quit building a DVD collection." and you can't blame her, honestly, because it was a little obnoxious. To get married and to also get a big boy job at the same time was a dangerous combo for me as a person who likes to collect things. But then eventually just sort of had to tone it down and not even from the overreaching in the first year, but just sort of just couldn't do it for a while. So this is the first year I've been able to really participate. And so I got a couple, I think I got three or four in July, and I got four this past weekend, and I actually nice. Expect to go back and maybe get one or two more before the sale goes up because I decided there's a lot of weird fun and just going back and looking and picking a couple more. So I sort of budgeted for the month for six. And so I said, okay, I'll do four now. And then I'll wait and think, oh, I should have gotten this. Cause that's what I always do. I walk away and go, oh, right. And so I've got two more, that I'll probably go back and get. And then in July, I think I'm going to go for a box set. But right now I'm sticking it at six and I'm pretty happy with it, but it's such a fun, film nerd time of the year to go to, let's go to Barnes and Noble and buy movies, not books.
Yeah, I have a tendency, because the sale runs an entire month, to kind of like load up the first time I go out there. And then of course there are releases every Tuesday through the month of November. So 2 days ago or day ago, I guess, I was out there picking up The Philadelphia Story, which mm-hmm. was the release this week. And then next week they're going to have Les Samurai out on Blu-ray. And so undoubtedly I will pick that one up. And so, yeah, it can add up on you. You know, you can convince yourself, it's $20 this week. And, then you start adding it up with what you've spent on the sale and maybe other movies that you acquire that aren't Criterion films. And then, whatever you may be renting or purchasing or whatnot digitally. And the next thing you realize, wow, I got a pretty sizable entertainment budget going here.
Exactly. All of a sudden, a hobby is a $250 monthly bill.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the one advantage that I have that is worth pointing out so that all the listeners don't think, you know, wow, he must be some independently wealthy dude or something. I don't have children. So that is a huge equalizer in the world of home expenses. You spend far more on your little fella in a month than I ever spend on movies. And so that's just one of the reasons that I have a little bit of discretionary income that most of my fellow film lovers don't have.
Well, actually, you know, I tried to tell my two-year-old that for his future, I'm investing in him if he'll just skip a couple of meals. And he just looked at me and went, booze? And so and it's like, okay, it's not working out, this argument. So, but yeah, I think that Les Samurai is actually, that's the big debate, because this is what I do. I refuse to order anything because that's too easy. I'm such a weird person. And so I won't let them order anything for me. So I go, and if it's in stock, it's an option. So yep. for this time around, the three movies out of my four I knew I would get. I knew I'd get Personal Shopper. That was number one on my list for the new mm-hmm. releases. But I also wanted to finally pick up a copy of Yi Yi, Francis Ha. Oh, Yi Yi is one of my very favorites. Francis Ha, which is a movie I've seen probably a dozen times and for no mm-hmm. good reason I've never purchased. And Punch Drunk Love, right? And so Personal Shopper.
That's a good group.
Personal Shopper's right there on the front. It's a newer release. It's I got that immediately. All three of the others were gone. And so I went with my next ring of things, And so now I'm going, okay, I'm going to go back in. And if they have Les Samurai, because I really want it. So that's going to make it my number one, because I know it'll be there when I get there. And then hopefully they've restocked to one of the other three, or it's going to be a surprise. So, this is how much I think about this stuff.
Well, you're like me. I mean, it's like, it's hard at 48 years old to recreate the feeling of, you know, waking up before the sun comes up on Christmas morning and, going and making your parents get out of bed so that you can open your presents. And the closest that I've probably come to that is strolling through the front door of Barnes & Noble on the first day of the sale, because I have, you know, sworn off buying these usually for 4, 5, 6 months leading up to the sale. And this is the time that I'm going to splurge and get some. And so, you know, I'm like a little kid tearing into his Christmas presents on Christmas morning when I come out of Barnes & Noble with my bag. So I do the same thing. I don't go to barnesandnoble.com. I don't order them by mail. You know, that's like in a way like cheating to me or something. It's I want to hold them in my hand and look at it and decide which ones I'm going to get. So I'm a total nerd when it comes to that.
Well, you mentioned other purchases of DVDs you're trying to add to your collection. I know you have a few boutique retailers you frequent, but I wanted to mention I also made a recent my first purchase from a more sort of new to the scene relatively company called Plain Archive. And I feel like we've talked about Plain Archive in the last few weeks privately. Have you heard of this Korean company that puts out these beautiful sets of steelbooks of films, sort of in the Criterion vein, but usually newer releases?
Yes, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. And yeah, they're usually limited to maybe even in the hundreds as opposed to in the thousands sometimes. And they're these really, if you like packaging and artwork and the actual release kind of being its own little piece of art, so to speak, they're an awesome little boutique label for that kind of stuff, because it's unique. It doesn't look anything like the mass marketed version that will come out that you can get at Best Buy or, you know, Amazon, the store of your choice. Yes, I'm very familiar with them. Unfortunately, I don't own that much of their stuff, but it's a really cool concept.
But they do these boxes, right? Where so like a Foxcatcher was a more recent one where they did a shoebox. It was like a wrestling shoebox, and they include as much stuff as they can, whether it's artwork, pictures, buttons, and like pins like you would wear or put on your satchel bag, all sorts of stuff. And so one of my favorite films of the last few years is Xavier Dolan's Mommy. And so they announced they were releasing it with one of these big deluxe box sets and then several steelbook options. And I forgot about it, but happened to just pop on the internet like 30 minutes after they went on sale, pulled up the website, had the box in like the nicest version of things in my cart, realized my wallet was in my car. I was at work, walked to my car and came back. And by the time I came back, they had sold out. And so, so you're right on the limited edition, but they still had the steelbooks in. So they basically have a pared down version, but you still get the box includes one of these steelbooks. And so I did pick up one of the steelbook editions. So I'm excited to pre-order. I'm a little confused on when it's actually going to come to me. So there's some things lost in translation, but I've ordered it. They've got my money, so I better get my Blu-ray. but we'll see. And I'll report along the way about my first plane archive experience.
You know, some of these, when you look at the secondary market, when you look at like eBay, when these things sell out, you start asking yourself, why do I have a 401k or some kind of investment fund? Because, you know, you could buy this Blu-ray 6 months ago for $20, and after it sold out, you can now sell it for $200 on eBay. You know, where am I going to have a 10 times my investment gain in the course of 6 months? You start thinking you ought to be playing the Blu-ray market instead of the stock market.
I mean, you're not kidding. It is pretty amazing, especially the first time I tried to get one was they put out a pretty incredible box set for Carol, the movie Carol, and I missed it, and that's one that I really wanted, and I saw the secondary market prices and said, I'll just never own that. That's okay.
Exactly.
So usually what we also do is talk about what we've been watching. So have you been to the movies in the last week?
Yeah, actually, I've seen a couple of things over the last week. I have seen the Miles Teller kind of military-based drama called Thank You for Your Service. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I have not, but I remember your text. You seemed to respond pretty strongly to it.
Yeah, it you know, the title, and you really kind of pick up on it as the movie is going. You know, initially that sounds like it's going to be some patriotic rah-rah, chest-thumping, you know, kind of thing, you know, thank you for your service. And you realize as you're watching the movie that it's basically sarcasm. It is the story of these guys who were in the enlisted ranks in the Army. It's set in the mid-2000s, so it's like 2006, 2007, and they're coming home from the Middle East and getting out of the service, and how they just, you know, they can't get their VA benefits started, you know, they can't get any kind of medical or psychological treatment, they can't find jobs, and it sounds super depressing, which at times it is, but, you know, it makes you look at the way in which it's kind of, you know, what have you done for me lately? That, you know, we use up these poor kids and throw them away, and some of them have traumatic brain injuries, some of them have PTSD, you know, psychological issues, physical disabilities, and it's like, you know, we love them while we're using them and salute them and everything, and then when they get home, we defund, you know, everything that they need, and they just get forgotten. And so this film, you realize that, you know, that slogan, thank you for your service, is really kind of probably said with disdain or sarcasm, because we don't thank them when they get back. And so it's a really good film about a trio of guys who served overseas, and then they kind of go down different paths. You know, I mean, so many of our former veterans, you know, fall into crime, fall into homelessness, fall into drug addiction, all of these different things, suicide. And so what you see is amongst this group of three, kind of that array of possible fates that you could fall into if you slip through the cracks. And so being in a military town, two of my best friends are retired military or army officers who commanded men like this. And so I've been around it a lot over the last 20 years. And it's just the next time you see a, you know, enlisted kid go walking by, it definitely changes your thought processes about what they're going through and what they're going to face when they get out.
Gotcha. And so how was Miles Teller? I haven't seen him in something in a while.
You know, he's really good. Miles Teller, for me, tends to be a little bit overdone. You know, he tends to be a little on the melodrama side of things, a little, you know, heavy with the tears and the grimaces and the anger and stuff like that. And which comes sometimes with young actors. And so this performance, I thought, was very subdued, you know, not to the point of like being boring or anything like that, but it was just much more subtle than what I have seen out of him before. I mean, he very much plays a guy who's kind of trying to keep his composure and is trying to hold it together for his wife and his kids as he's going through all of these things when his military service wraps up. And so I really enjoyed seeing that side of him. It was a performance out of him unlike most anything else that I've seen him do.
Very cool. No, I definitely want to check it out. You're right. The growing up in a military town, it's a different perspective. It's easy for media in general to sort of you turn being in the military into being a type or being a character almost. And it's hard to, I mean, I've worked so many different little weird retail jobs around that city. So whether it's a grocery store, a movie theater, a catering facility where, you know, enlisted guys, when they got married, they would, you just meet so many different people, and it's a very humanizing thing to be exposed to them instead of turning them into a character piece, which is what most, I feel, movies and media do. And so this sounds like something I'd definitely be interested in engaging with the conversation it's trying to have.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's not explosive stuff.
Yeah.
It's just heavy character stuff. I mean, things just as simple as, you know, you're getting off a plane and for whatever reason, you know, your wife isn't there to greet you and you go to, you know, post housing or the house off post that you're renting and they're just gone. You know, it's like you were deployed for 14, 15 months. They couldn't take it anymore. They left to go live with family or go wherever. You know, the utilities in your house are turned off. You know, the money in your bank account is gone. It's like they just cut ties with you and said, we can't take this anymore. And so instead of coming home to, you know, a hero's welcome or some kind of fanfare, you just come home to a personal life that's in a shambles.
Yeah.
And so the drama is based out of those types of scenarios. It's not necessarily, you know, action driven or kind of explosive kind of developments. It's just very much the real world reintegrating into life after you've been off leading, you know, a 14-month deployment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That sounds, you know me. I love a movie that dives deep into character, doesn't it? Which is going to be funny when we get to talking about Thor in a little bit. But I do love a movie that's much more focused on the person and not necessarily the plot. And so that sounds very interesting. More interesting than honestly the marketing like made it feel to me. So that's a very interesting endorsement. I'm looking forward to it. I believe before we get to Thor, which we've both seen, you saw the new George Clooney joint. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about it, because I've been hearing some things about it.
It may not be as bad as what you are hearing, but it's also not very good. Okay. So it's kind of like a matter of degree. These people like, oh, George Clooney should never direct again. Oh, this is a total disaster. You know, it's just terrible. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. That's going a little bit far. I've seen a lot of stuff in 2017 that is worse than Suburbicon. But it isn't very good. And in a way, you know, when you hear after the fact that it is a script from the Coen brothers that was shelved for a while, you kind of start to understand it a little bit more, you know, because half of the film I'm watching and I'm like, you know, this is almost like a first draft of their film, The Man Who Wasn't There.
Okay.
It's like this take on like Double Indemnity and kind of old black and white Hitchcock films. You know, the husband is, you know, planning something evil against the wife to get her out of the way so he can pick up with another woman and collect the insurance money and all these kind of things. And so it's like one story kind of has this like Dial M for Murder kind of feel to it, which is ultimately kind of like what The Man Who Wasn't There is kind of feeding off of, but it's a much better version of that idea. And then there's this other story about race and a African-American family moving to town and, of course, being met with total, you know, revulsion, I guess you would say, by the people in town. Not wanting them to be there, discriminating against them, harassing them, making their life horrible so that they'll move out of the town. This is a period piece, by the way, set in like the 50s. And so that is one of the plot lines. But the weird thing is, it's like two 45-minute movies that have been cut together. I mean, the one plot line and set of characters in your Double Indemnity, Dial M for Murder mystery side of it, virtually never interact with the characters involved in the other side of it. There's almost no overlap. The only overlap is they're living in the same neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has this strange feeling of like you're watching two 45-minute short films that have been spliced together.
Yeah, wow.
And so it just doesn't work. And one of the weird things is, you know, I laughed when I saw the previews of it, when I saw the trailer. It kind of seemed to have this little absurdist black humor kind of streak to it that some of the Coen brothers films can have. But it was like that 2 or 3 minute trailer cut together every one of those bits that is in the movie. And there is no more of that kind of a tone to the movie. So, I mean, I was in a theater with, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 people in the theater, not one laugh out loud at any point during the entire film.
Wow, that's so weird. That's crazy.
Yeah, so from the comedy standpoint of things, not that funny. And then from the drama side of things, not that well done. So certainly something that I would not recommend. I just don't think that it's the, you know, unmitigated disaster that everybody is portraying it as, but it's definitely a flawed film and with all the stuff out there to choose from, it is not one that I would recommend you go spend your time and money on.
Gotcha. So I do want to ask you on a TV level before, because again, I guess we're teasing Thor now. All of a sudden, that's become my mode for the week, because I don't know where you stand on Thor, and I'd be in a laugh if we're on totally different pages, because we could have an interesting conversation. But Did you watch any Stranger Things? Are you a Stranger Things guy?
Yes, I am a Stranger Things fan. I have not seen any of the new season. It's just one of those, you know, just kind of real world, real life intervention kind of things where I just haven't had the time to sit down and kind of sink my teeth into it. But one of the reasons is not a total lack of time. It's I was hooked on Mindhunter that we have spoken about before on this podcast. And so rather than have two shows going at the same time, I finished Mindhunter, and then now I'm ready to explore the new season of Stranger Things. So I guess the good news in that was I was so hooked on Mindhunter and enjoying it so much, I did not want to cast it aside to begin Stranger Things.
Did Mindhunter's end satisfactorily for you? Were you happy?
Yeah, it did. It did. It just it after you get through that first episode, which is, you know, a little on the slow side and maybe not as creatively what you would want it to be, it just starts building a head of steam with episode two and just keeps rolling. And really ends with maybe not an out-and-out, like, whodunit kind of cliffhanger, but it definitely ends with you kind of on the edge of your seat as to where the show's going to go next year.
Very cool. That's good to hear. Well, I did watch somehow, and honestly, I feel like I went into the Upside Down to find time to do it, but I did watch all of season two since we last talked, so I did get that in, and I gotta say, it is a show that's, in the first season, the mystery, and I'm not gonna spoil anything for anyone who hasn't had time to watch it, because as many people as I get older, the more my friend groups fracture, I watch half the people I know totally have time to watch it in 2 days, and the other half can't imagine being able to binge a show in a day or two. And so I'm not spoiling anything here, but I just want to say generally it's a show that proves an odd experience, because season one I enjoyed so much of the mystery and the mythology and the sort of fantasy creepy stuff as well as the kid stuff, and in season two I could have genuinely just hung out with these kids like a Freaks and Geeks season where they just went to school. And I would have preferred that. It's not that I dislike season two. It does has a few missteps along the way, but they added an episode. Netflix seems to have an issue with sometimes going too long and not knowing when enough's enough, or they just don't edit things. And so I feel like it's an episode or two too long. But also, I'm also coming from the perspective that I just would have wished I could have hung out with just the kids and the parents and just the people. There's a couple of new cast members this year, Sean Astin and Paul Reiser, and they're both fantastic. I haven't liked Paul Reiser so much. I haven't thought he was as good as he is in this in quite some time, but I haven't liked him as much, maybe ever. And so I think they were great additions for the season, and so I think not as good as season one because you lost that wow new factor, but still very enjoyable, but proves itself flawed in that it's so much more enjoyable just to hang out with the kids than to explore the fantasy stuff. So I would recommend it, though. If you like season one, there's no question you will get plenty of enjoyment out of season two. And the kid moments and the character stuff is so good that anything that isn't quite as good is sort of overshadowed by the greatness of these kid actors. They're just fantastic. I hope they stay happy, healthy kids and grow into well-rounded adults, because they're providing some great entertainment for a lot of people with this show.
That's awesome. I look forward to seeing that. And, you know, you triggered something in my mind that was the other explanation for why I haven't seen any of Stranger Things, as you said, the name Paul Reiser. And my wife and I watched the third and final season of the Amazon Prime series Red Oaks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I didn't know it was the final season.
Have you seen any of Red Oaks?
I've seen the pilot on your recommendation. I really liked it and didn't continue on just because of my brain and just missed it. But I plan to watch it. I didn't know it was the final season, and I know you like it. How'd it go?
Yeah, it's great. It works really well, and kind of like you just saying that sometimes Netflix doesn't know how to overstay, you know, how to avoid overstaying its welcome. You know, a 13 episode season seems like it could be done 10. A 10 episode season seems like it could be done in 8. There always seems to be extra and some padding in there that you could have lost. And so Red Oaks had two 10-episode seasons over the last couple of years, and then this final season is only 6 episodes. And so I was disappointed because it's only a 30-minute show. So I was like, oh, man, I can't believe, you know, it's only 6 episodes instead of 10, which means it's basically 3 hours and the season is done. But I have to tell you, they did such a great job of wrapping everything up, giving you a satisfying conclusion to a character arc. It may not be a happy ending for everybody. It may not be exactly what you wanted to happen, but you had plausible resolutions to all of the different characters. And it's a serialized dramedy is really what I would call it. It's not an out and out, just laugh a second sitcom, but it's also not a drama. It has, you know, parts that can be, you know, somber and serious, and then it has parts that can be laugh out loud funny. And so it takes place at a country club in the 80s. I think 1987 is when the first season is. And it's mostly about kind of that country club summer culture. You have the young kids who are working as valets and junior tennis pros and lifeguards and stuff like that. And then you have the parents and the adult characters, of course, who are the people coming to the country club to play golf and enjoy themselves. And so it's like the stories of this group of characters, the adults and the younger folks. And it carries over from week to week. And so it's serialized storytelling, and it's really good. It's a show that has heart. You know, it's not like one of these just sarcastic, smart alecky kind of shows where all of the laughs are just, you know, some kind of cruelty joke about somebody. It's very clever humor, very character driven stuff. And it has, you know, it has some heart and a little bit of feel good to it without ever really being sappy. And so, but Paul Reiser is just awesome on that show. So when you said, I don't know that I've ever seen him and liked him as much as in Stranger Things season 2, well, roll right on over to Red Oaks, because I think it's one of the best things he's ever done.
Honestly, because of how much I liked him in Stranger Things, you may have just sold me on putting Red Oaks in front of other things to watch. So that's very exciting.
He plays like a Bernie Madoff kind of character.
Okay.
He plays like this investment broker. He's kind of like, you know, it's set in the 80s. He's kind of like this show's like Gordon Gekko.
Okay.
Like the hard-nosed business guy who's taken tennis lessons from our young character who's kind of the protagonist of the show.
Okay. Very cool.
And just does a super good job, because that would be such an easy character to just hate throughout. Like, oh, God, what a scumbag. And instead, it's like, you know, I like him. Oh, God, I can't believe he did that. I don't like him. Oh, I like him. And so by the end of the show, he's just this really well-rounded kind of guy that's just a real person. And that's so often tough to do in a comedy setting.
Very cool. Well, before we jump into the recent Marvel outing, any other things you've been catching up with lately?
Very quickly, I saw the documentary 7852.
That's right.
The film
about Psycho, about the shower scene.
Yes. Yes. And it's fantastic. The title refers to the 78 camera setups and the 52 actual film edits that went into filming the shower scene in Psycho. And so it does a really good job. You're initially thinking, how in the world can you have like an hour and 40 minute documentary on 3 minutes of footage? Mm-hmm. And the answer is they do a lot of kind of a sociological kind of setup for you, you know, kind of like what was the film world like leading up to Psycho, and, you know, showing all of your kind of, you know, technicolor, you know, romance, adventure kind of things. And then all of a sudden this just dark movie comes out of nowhere to just kind of gobsmack the entire country the weekend that it came out. And you have a lot of guests, you know, film directors, actors, actresses, producers, everybody commenting on, you know, the importance of the scene, what they get out of the scene. And really, by the time the film is over, it plays almost partially like a commentary track to the film of Psycho. And it doesn't explore the entire film of Psycho. It doesn't explore it chronologically, but it points out some moments in the film that if you're a fan of the film, you're going to go, oh my gosh, I never noticed that, or I never thought about that. And it just shows you what a masterpiece that film is and how everything in the beginning of the film is leading to that shower scene and how everything after the film is informed by that scene. And it's a really interesting concept that I never would have considered for a documentary. And it's, to me, it's one of the more pleasant surprises of the year.
That's awesome. Very cool. Very cool. And so with that, I don't have anything else because all I've been thinking about is Thor for a few days. Let's talk about Marvel's latest. So we've discussed in this podcast superhero movies, and we have discussed sort of the fun of superhero movies in this past year and how that's been such a refreshing thing, aside from Logan's seriousness. But even then, that was a good film, so we're not a knock on superhero movies with Logan. I saw Thor. I have been talking about Thor pretty much consistently since I walked out of it on Friday. I'm a big fan. Scott, what did you think of Thor Ragnarok?
You know, first I will say I'm a huge Taika Waititi fan.
Yes.
So I have enjoyed all of his previous films, find them hilarious in their own individual, quirky kind of way. And I felt the same way about this.
That's cool. I
just thought it had, you know, such a sense of character and such a great sense of humor, and it felt like there was a need to kind of shift away from so much self-importance in these movies. You know, I've used the expression before, you know, heavy is the head that wears the cowl, you know, those types of films that, you know, everything is dark and everything is angsty. And, you know, my view of this is I got that done really, really well in the Dark Knight trilogy. I don't need to keep watching that same idea. And so to watch the Marvel universe kind of, you know, lighten up and quite literally brighten up in a film, I thought was a blast.
Yeah, it's so funny. I've been thinking a lot about, because I'm one of the few people who really enjoyed the first Thor film. I know that it's flawed. I see its flaws, but I really do enjoy it. I love the fish out of water stuff with the superhero genre and or characters. And but this has been a series with Thor of, you know, the second movie is called The Dark World. Like, they really try to make it so serious, and in the end it's a blonde surfer dude with a hammer that he spins around like a helicopter and flies with it, and there's a level of going like, you know, we could just have more fun. And that's what I like so much about the first one, is I was able to find a lot of fun in the first one.
Yeah, and like a great bit about how does one ride a hammer.
Exactly.
That's a good moment in it.
And so for me, this just kind of realizes the potential of what it could have been this whole time. There's a moment where it is so outrageously, flamboyantly, just crazy fun with a giant dog and the Hulk, and they're flying through the air at each other, and it's like I don't listen to metal music, but it reminds me of a metal music album cover. And
and that was part of his inspiration for the movie.
And I think I shouted, like I said something, I exclaimed excitement in the theater when the shot it came on, because at that point I'm an hour and 45 minutes or so into the film, and I've had such a good time. I am fully in Waititi's hands to just have a blast, and that's from beginning of the movie through the very end. I never stopped having fun.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right, and it's funny that you should name that kind of touchstone for the visuals, because Taika Waititi has said in interviews that one of the things that he wanted to use was kind of these 1970s album covers for all of these prog rock bands that were so into like mythology and, you know, these weird, you know, arcane kind of lyrics and stuff. And so he was like, I was thinking about, you know, Yes and Rush and, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer and King Crimson and all of these bands that would just have these, you know, crazy like tableaus on the front cover of their albums. And so the scene with the Valkyries fighting Hela and a couple of the other scenes were inspired, you know, by album cover art. And so that was a very real influence on the film. But I'm with you on just it being fun. I mean, I think, and I won't say what it is, but we'll just say there's a moment where Bruce Banner jumps out of a helicopter to come to the rescue that just literally I'm doing one of those lists like you have done in the past of like some of my favorite film moments of the year. And that will undoubtedly be in the upper echelon of that list, because that was just a riot. And so it's just fun to see a movie that can poke fun at itself, kind of take a little wind out of its own sails when it gets a little too self-important. And so it was just, I mean, it's like a rip-roaring adventure. The thing that it reminded me the most of, and I don't know if this is something that you're a fan of or even saw because of the age gap between the two of us, but it reminds me so much of that movie Flash Gordon.
Yeah, I've seen it like long time ago. I can definitely see that, the color palette and the wildness of the whole thing.
Yep. Exactly, just the visual style and the kind of synthy sound, you know. That movie had a real kind of synth-heavy Queen score, and so it very much straddled the line of kind of just like campy versus fun, though Flash Gordon fell much more into the campy category. Ironically, most people probably know what they know about Flash Gordon from the film Ted.
Yep.
If you remember, they were obsessed with the movie Flash Gordon, and so a lot of times if you mention Flash Gordon, nobody has any idea what you're talking about, but then if you mention that it was in Ted, they're like, oh yeah, that movie, yeah, I know what you're talking about. But just the sensibilities of it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's so interesting because these Marvel films, and we've sort of talked about this again at the beginning of this podcast, like our first episode, I believe. There's such a need to tie them together, right? And you know, this is going to lead into that, and that's there in the after credit stuff this time around. But at some point, I just sort of disconnected from that as part of the real movie. And so, but by the time the credits do start, pre any after credit scenes, this film isn't beholden to anything else. There's a cameo in the middle, but really doesn't matter that you've seen anything else, because the joke that's being played doesn't matter what happened in the film that character was featured in. Right. And there's no search for an Infinity Stone. There's no Thanos blue guy on a throne somewhere. It's just, it's all about Thor's going on an adventure. He's got to figure out what's going on in his home, and his long lost sister shows up to wreak some havoc, and the havoc is so much fun. But they even actively make fun of some of that stuff, and that's just so. Everything about this movie is so aware of what it is expected to be, but is constantly proving how much it doesn't need that to be fun. And I think that's just giving, honestly, Chris Hemsworth a chance to be funny. I have not seen the Ghostbusters film from last year for no good reason. No, I have no opinion. Like, I think it's cool they have Lady Ghostbusters. I'm not like one of those guys who held out on it. I just didn't see it. But I've heard he's hysterical in that. Did you see Ghostbusters?
You know, I didn't, and it was the same kind of thing. I wasn't some conscientious objector. It was just one of those releases that hit in an ocean of other releases, and I heard less than glowing things about it, so I just focused my time and money on other films. But you know, everybody cites the fact that they felt like they could go this comedic direction because of his performance in that film.
And the other is his Saturday Night Live experience appearances, which I have seen, and he is very funny. And in interviews, he's always been so funny, naturally just funny. And so they just lean into it hard. And I think that's great. And then I feel like everybody in the cast knows exactly what they're doing. Mark Ruffalo's hysterical. Tessa Thompson just chews up every scene that she is in. She's so great. And Cate Blanchett, honestly, I think Hela has, she's a little undercooked as a character, but good God, is she having a good time being just a vicious bad lady, you know?
Yep. Yep. And then add in, you know, Jeff Goldblum at full Goldblum.
Oh man. It's like he became an internet meme on screen.
And then, of course, I can't remember the name of the character. It's the rock guy.
Korg, K-O-R-G.
Yeah, exactly, which is voiced by Taika Waititi. So hearing that New Zealand accent come out of that character and to hear him adding comedic relief to his own comedic film is really a kick. So, it's been a surprisingly good year for comic book films. I mean, if at the beginning of 2017 you'd said we're going to have Logan, we're going to have Guardians of the Galaxy 2, we're going to have Wonder Woman, we're going to have Thor, you know, my immediate reaction was kind of like, oh God, seriously, like four, and then there's Justice League still to come, so five.
And then Spider-Man as well.
Sorry, forgot Spider-Man. But the interesting thing was that so many of them went new places. You know, like with Logan, you had the R-rated aspect of it. So it was a lot more hardcore in some of its violence and things than most of your comic book films. But then it also really had this Western flavor to it, you know, kind of a Man with No Name, Clint Eastwood kind of Western feel. And then Wonder Woman just had like that old school kind of charm to it that was so nice. And then Thor with the sense of humor, and then Spider-Man with kind of more of a John Hughes high school kind of storyline to it that really, you know, none of them fell into your typical pigeonhole of what a comic book film is. And if that trend continues, I think there's a lot of life in this genre. If it just becomes the never ending, a bad guy has an important object and we have to stop him from using whatever said object is to destroy the world, and it all ends in a big blue light at the end of the film, you can tell from my sarcasm that I've kind of grown tired of that three act structure. And yes. So this year gave me hope that these characters and intellectual properties have more life in them than I might have thought.
It's funny. It actually ended up having the opposite effect that I think was intended in the Avengers film coming. So we have Black Panther in the first quarter of the year, and in the second we have the Avengers Infinity War. And what the effect this movie had was that it completely deflated my excitement for the Avengers film and made me 10 times more excited for Black Panther, because now I just let them go off on their own and do things. I hope Avengers is great. But I feel it's going to have to, with as many moving pieces, be more like that structure that you're talking about. But Black Panther, which the trailer played before Thor, so just as a reminder of how cool and different that looks. And I was just reading something where it's gone so far as the Chadwick Boseman, the lead, the actor who was playing T'Challa, the Black Panther, didn't even let any his accent is fully African in the movie, right, to completely separate his character from anything that is influenced by another culture outside of his country. So much. But my point with all of that interesting little pop-up video factoid is that this is going to be something different in its own way, and that's I'm all for that.
Yep, and I remember as a kid reading the Black Panther comic books, or, you know, the comic books that he appeared in, and just being fascinated by it. I mean, it was like all these names that I really couldn't pronounce and this culture that I wasn't familiar with. And so it was just like this whole other world that exists in our actual world because we're just not familiar with it. And so being introduced to that culture and those characters, I was just fascinated by it as a kid. And so now to see it, you know, come to life in a film that'll be unlike any of the other Marvel films is exciting.
No, absolutely, man. It's shocking to me because I used to say to friends that the sort of comic booky nerdy conversations, the best year of comic book movies was 2008, because Iron Man and The Dark Knight are that year, and Hellboy 2 as well, which is I'm a huge fan of Hellboy 2, and I never would have bet. I mean, I remember all the articles last year about all of the sequels and the continuations and the comic book movies. I never would have put money on this year being the best movie, the year for comic book movies. And good yep. Lord, man, I can't. Even if Justice League is a full failure, like if it came out and was just terrible, right? In about, it's less than 2 weeks, it'll be here, which is still weird to me. But if it comes out and it fails, I would still call this the best movie, the best year for comic book movies we've ever had because of the consistent quality of so many comic book movies. Right. One failure yep. is not going to ruin this year. It's such a good year for comic book movies, and I never would have guessed.
Yeah, no, I'm with you completely on that.
It's funny. I will also say in full admission that in my top five movies anticipating for the year, this was in it. I've been waiting for a Thor movie I could truly love, and it's rare that these kind of films, which are associated with so much more than just an objective experience, I have investment in money with comic books and time and conversation. I never would have expected it to live up to expectations, but it did in such a way that only The Dark Knight has ever fully done before it. It's just such a different tone. And I think it's proof positive that exactly what you started this conversation with, it's so not necessary to go dark to be successful. It's just to follow a unique voice. And in this case, it was Waititi's who basically rebooted Thor and made it into a comedy series. And that's great. It was exactly what it needed, and it made this the best comic book film of the year for me. I loved it.
Yeah, no, I agree completely, and I think that that's one thing that I would be interested in seeing the Star Wars franchise be willing to do is to let a filmmaker put their actual stamp on a movie, as opposed to getting into creative differences with interesting filmmakers and just cutting them loose because they're not willing to make the movie exactly like the studio thinks it needs to be made. And so one of my big curiosities is somebody like Rian Johnson, whose work that I love, can he do a Taika Waititi, so to speak, in Star Wars? And I don't mean make it a comedy, but I mean just make it something that is his, as opposed to, just corporate product.
My theory is, this is my true theory with that, because I've obviously spent a lot of time, thinking about Star Wars. And the reason Rian Johnson's had such a smooth ride of this, the way he's talked about it, but he wrote something that they approved of. And they said, go make that. And it seems like I can't believe I just forgot their names, the guys, Lord and Miller, who were fired and replaced by Ron Howard. and then now apparently he filmed over 80% of the reshot over 80% so he can get sole director credit. It's crazy what's going on with that movie, the Han Solo movie, but they didn't write what they were shooting. And so I feel like the lesson learned out there is to say, hey guys, Lucasfilm, start with a writer director that you're interested in. Let them write something. If you like it, then let him shoot it or her shoot it. But don't hire guns. Don't hire creatives as guns for hire. And so I think that's the missing element. And I hate that Han Solo or Solo is not going to be the other film that it could have been. I'll always wonder what that could have been. I hope it is good no matter what, but I will always wonder. And I wonder if we see Rian Johnson's Star Wars and we go, oh yes, that was definitely Rian Johnson's Star Wars. That'll probably add credence to my theory if it works, that you got to let him write it, so get that approved, and then leave him alone to make what they wrote. Cause that seemed to be the big issue with Lord and Miller, is they weren't shooting what was written that someone else wrote.
Exactly.
And so, I'm with you on that. I get Taika to do a Star Wars movie. I let them bring the Ewoks back if Taika could do the film. So I'm glad we both like Thor. That's exciting. It's the first time in quite a few episodes where we've seen the same movie in the theater. And so I'm glad that we both enjoyed it. Are you seeing anything over the next week or so? Anything you're looking forward to?
I was looking forward to Murder on the Orient Express, but I have been seeing at least headlines and tweets and whatnot that it's not so great. Mm-hmm. So that took a little wind out of my sails. Matter of fact, I had suggested to some friends, rather than going to see that, Maybe we ought to get together and watch the 1974 Sidney Lumet version with just that all-star cast of just amazing actors and actresses of that era, so that if you're going to learn the plot twists and turns and whodunit, maybe we would like to watch one that is fairly universally acclaimed as opposed to the new one, which isn't.
Yeah, it's actually I watched that for the first time a few months ago and really enjoyed it. So I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're going to have a little watching party over here at our place and watch the one that is, 40-some-odd years old instead.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's on my horizon. I'm a little behind in my Juliette Binoche watching, and I've got four or five DVDs here. I have gone... One day we've got to talk about my... I've got to talk to you about my my film goals for a year and how I choose what I watch. But part of it is adding more women to my top actors watched of all time. Right. And so I've got her and Kate Blanchett on the list, and I'm just trying to get them above, honestly, a few people who are now known as terrible people. And so I'm trying to bump Johnny Depp further down my list, because I've seen a lot of Johnny Depp movies, like not only but just something that's happened. And so I've got a few more that I can bump her above Johnny Depp, which I'd feel a success in this year. Do you have five more minutes for me to ask you about breaking news that just hit Twitter a few minutes ago?
Uh-oh, sure.
So I just read, because my phone started blowing up, that Kevin Spacey was going to be in a smaller part in Ridley Scott's newest film coming out this December. And I knew it had been pulled from AFI, which the film fest that our buddy Adam's going to. But they just announced that they are going to reshoot his parts with Christopher Plummer. And they are going to keep its December 22nd release date. So between now and December 22nd, they're going to completely reshoot Kevin Spacey's character's parts with all the actors agreeing to be a part of these reshoots and get it out on the same release date of December 22nd.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
That is amazing. You know, the thing that bothered me most about that, I'm no defender of Kevin Spacey, and so the fact that they're going to replace him is fine. The thing that hurt me was that Ridley Scott gets sucked into all of this.
Yes.
Because, you know, I mean, he's getting up there in age. He's probably only got a couple more films left in him. And so here's this, you know, film that he has made that we have every reason to believe would be of high quality. It's going to, you know, premiere at AFI Fest. And so I just hated it that he took the hit along with Kevin Spacey. And I mean, he was the one who spearheaded the effort of, hey, pull it from the AFI roster, you know, I don't want this to play under these circumstances. You know, I don't want this to take place. And so, you know, he manned up and did what had to be done. But I really hated it for him because he's just such a talented filmmaker and deserves to have the twilight of his career, be one of praise and appreciation as opposed to one of controversy. And so if they can pull that off and it doesn't harm the quality of the movie, I think that would be an awesome story, especially for Ridley Scott.
Yeah, what I did like is sort of in a similar vein to what you were just saying, he said he was stating that when the movie comes out, I don't want the thousands of people who ultimately worked on it to have to be overshadowed by Kevin Spacey's acts. And so I want to make sure he goes, but I also don't want to hide the movie. Like push it away, basically. The company, I think, said they don't want to just hide it. And so he insisted they're going to keep that release date and they're going to make it happen. He's getting on up in age, but he may have five or six more movies on him if he's got this kind of energy.
I hope so.
That's impressive. I can't believe that. I just saw that and just went, well, I got to mention it. We've talked a little bit about some of these things that have been going on in Hollywood. And it's just an amazing and very quick response to what's going on with Kevin Spacey. My uncle left me with these words of wisdom over the weekend when I saw him in this, the subject of our Hollywood heroes came up. He said, you know, just hold on to your hats. It's not over yet. It's just starting. But just remember, we're all going to be okay. So we just have to ride the storm, see what happens, see who comes out as an a-hole and who doesn't, and it sounds like some of the good guys are gonna I think that's a good guy move, Ridley Scott. So so I like it, and I like the justification for the reasons. So hopefully they pull it off. And at this point, even if it comes out to bad reviews, I think I've seen every Ridley Scott that he's made except for Exodus in the theater over the last 10 years. And so I'm giving him my money to hopefully make some of these reshoot money back, because that's bold move there.
Absolutely.
Well, Scott, where can people find you on the internet between now and our next episode?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me on Twitter. I am at Scott Phillips FD, with the FD, of course, being for film dispenser. And then thanks to you mentioning Letterboxd. Every episode that we have recorded, I have revived my Letterboxd account and have gone in and posted lots of reviews and done a lot of rating. And I've spent time over the last couple of weeks trying to get back up and running and current on that platform. So on Letterboxd, I'm simply Scott Phillips with a capital S and a capital P, all run together just by name, smooshed together. And so you can find me there as well. How about you?
Yeah, very nice. I'm on Letterboxd at Film Dispenser, and you can find me on Twitter at Film Dispenser. Basically, all social media platforms are Film Dispenser in their mind. I don't have too many things that aren't related to the website in terms of social media, so you won't find me posting too many, you know, political rants or personal pictures of my kid, except for my Facebook page, which you can't add me on because I'm private on Facebook. Everything's Film Dispenser everywhere, and on filmdispenser.com. I have a podcast I mentioned at the beginning of this one called the Utini Cast, which is a Star Wars podcast. It's on filmdispenser.com. Check that out. And I have a mystery tease for a new column I'm actually writing. I've been writing ahead of on my personal time that I'm going to start posting probably every week to 2 weeks that Scott doesn't know about. Nobody knows about. I tease it on the other podcast. I'm just going to say, come to filmdispenser.com every single day, and in the next few days, you're going to see a new column from me that I think you'll find to be a lot of fun.
Nice.
So check us out there. We'll be back next week. Like I said, the kid can't erase anything, and I got lots of contingency plans now, so we should be good talking about whatever we've watched. And who knows, maybe I'll see Murder on the Orient Express, the new version, and you'll watch the old school, and we'll talk about them.
Sounds good.
So, everybody, you guys have a great week, and we will see you and talk to you next week.
So I'm putting together a team.
Cool.
Like the old days. Surprise! This will be such fun.
Hello.
Hi.
He's a fighter.
Not a queen or a monster. I'm the goddess of death.